From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a new gun safety bill is introduced in the state legislature.
These mass shootings are tragic and they're horrible when they happen. But when we're talking about gun violence and gun deaths, over two-thirds are suicide.
Fiat Chrysler doubles down on its Jeep.
They're also making a statement that a real Jeep for the North American market comes out of the industrial Midwest.
An Oscar-winning director praises Shinola for saving Detroit, and Detroiters do a double take.
So my first response, frankly, was, oh, that's cool. Then the word sank in and I realized, oh, did he just say they're saving Detroit? That's not good.
And learning to love our bodies, the focus of a weekend Grand Rapids conference.
To be able to accept the good and the bad of my body, and not feel pressured to be this superhuman.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There is movement on new gun control legislation. Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin was speaking with us on Wednesday when she had to sign off for a House vote. The result of that vote, the House passed the first major gun control bill considered by Congress in nearly 25 years. It requires federal background checks for all firearm sales and transfers. With that backdrop comes a gun safety bill introduced Wednesday in Lansing. One of the co-sponsors is State Representative Robert Wittenberg. He's a Democrat from Huntington Woods. Representative, what would this legislation do?
So this is what's called, in some states they refer to it as red flag legislation. We refer to it as the extreme risk protection order. And so what it does is if there's a person that is a threat, an immediate threat to themselves or to other people, that we have some mechanism to be able to temporarily seize their weapons and prohibit them from buying new weapons. And it has due process built in, so a family member or law enforcement could petition a judge, and they have to present evidence, and then the judge will grant that order. It's in law in 11 different states, and we've been working on this. I'm in my third term, and this is something I've been pushing for since I first got here. And we think this would be a really important tool in the hands of family members and law enforcement to try to prevent these tragedies from happening.
Now, I know that you introduced a similar so-called red flag bill in the last session. And as you kind of touched on, there were some concerns expressed over the due process rights for gun owners. And there were also concerns among some in law enforcement that this could put officers in harm's way when they're sent out to confiscate someone's firearm. So tell us, break down for us what's changed.
So I'll answer that second point first, as far as putting them in harm's way. This is on the books in now 11 other states, but even at the time, there were four or five states that had it on the books, and there were a couple states that had it on the books for years, Connecticut and Indiana, for I think it was like 11, 12, 13 years, something like that. And that's just never been the case, right? Whenever they've served these orders, there's just no history of that ever happening. There was never an incident like that. And so what changed this time, we did a lot of the same things. It's the same mechanism. But what we did is we made sure that we weren't too broad on who could initiate the order. Before we had it, so it was a little more open, but we wanted to be a little more specific as to who could initiate the order. And so that's why it's specifically law enforcement or a family member.
And just to let everyone know that we're talking about House Bills 4283 through 4285, if you want to track them down and read them for yourself. And here's the politics. Do you have any Republican colleagues on board?
We don't have any Republican colleagues that co-sponsored this legislation, but I can tell you I've had many conversations with Republicans who said, we love the work you're doing, please keep it up. And if it gets to them to vote, they would be supportive. And so that's something I like to hear. And this is something I don't think it should be partisan. Like I said, it's on the books in 11 other states. A lot of those are Republican-leaning states, if you will. You even have Republican federal legislators who are working on this. Marco Rubio has been working on this at the federal level, worked on it last term, reintroduced it this session. Even here in our state, Congressman Upton introduced this bill, actually worked with Congresswoman Dingell, on this legislation. So I don't think this should be a partisan issue. Again, there is due process. What we are trying to do is prevent these tragedies from happening. And just real quick, I wanted to mention, because part of this is, these mass shootings are tragic and they're horrible when they happen. But when we're talking about gun violence and gun deaths, over two-thirds are suicide. And so this is, we think, a great mechanism to try to prevent suicide. And there are, from other states, they've done studies. in Connecticut over a 13-year period, or roughly 13-year period, that for every 10 to 20 orders that were initiated, they saved a person's life from suicide. So that's the kind of stuff we want to be doing. We want to be preventive. We want to be proactive. We don't want to be reactive. Unfortunately, a lot of these passed after Parkland, after what happened out at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. People said, well, what should we be doing? Well, we've been doing that here in Michigan. We've been trying to get this implemented, you know, since I first got here into the legislature. And I started, I'm a co-chair and the co-founder of the Legislative Gun Violence Prevention Caucus. So there are a lot of things that we're working on that are sensible, that do not take away someone's Second Amendment right. But we want to make sure that we have policy in place to try to prevent these things from happening.
You know, as you take the temperature of your House colleagues, particularly from the Republican side, what are some hang-ups you're hearing? What are concerns they have?
Well, you know, the original concern is due process, but there, you can't have any more due process than actually having a judge grant it. So I can always push back on that. And then, you know, there's some that just it's their philosophical position that they just don't want guns taken from anybody. But we know that's just not the case, right? We know currently there are people who are prohibited from having weapons. If you are a felon, if you've been adjudicated as mentally ill. So we know there are people that can have weapons, even in the Heller decision, right, from Justice Antonin Scalia, one of our most conservative Supreme Court justices, said there can be restrictions on the Second Amendment, just like there are on all amendments. So we know that that can be the case. Now we're just figuring out where we draw the line. And it's temporary. It's not indefinite. It's temporary. It's with due process. We think this is the tool, and so do other states, and that's why other states have implemented this legislation.
House Speaker Lee Chatfield is a strong gun rights supporter. What do you think it'll take to get him to put these bills up for a vote?
Well, Speaker Chatfield and I came in together. We actually really have a good relationship, and this is one of the issues we have a lot of conversations on. We have really good dialogue on this. You know, I don't know that answer, but I look forward to having that conversation. I think to be able to point to other states and say, this has not been partisan. You have Republicans and Democrats working on this, and this is a sensible solution to try to prevent these tragedies from happening, and we'll continue that dialogue. And so I think we don't want here in Michigan to be reactive. We don't want a tragedy to happen and where we say, oh, you know what, we should have done something. And you know, it's happening every day, though, when we talk about suicide and other things. So the longer we wait, unfortunately, more bad things are going to happen. So this is something that we really need to push forward as soon as possible.
State Representative Robert Wittenberg, Democrat from Huntington Woods. Thanks for being with us on Stateside.
Thanks, Cynthia. Talk to you soon.
News broke this week that Fiat Chrysler wants to invest $4.5 billion and create 6,500 jobs in the Detroit area, all to polish its Jeep and Ram brands. Detroit News business columnist Daniel House believes it is hard to overestimate the symbolism and the economic import of this news. Daniel, exactly what's FCA proposing to do and to build?
Well, they're going to take an engine plant that they shuttered in 2012 called Mach 2 and combine it with Mach 1, which is a functioning engine plant, and make it into a second Jeep Grand Cherokee assembly plant in the city of Detroit. Currently, the Grand Cherokee comes out of the Jefferson North Assembly Plant in Detroit. They are going to introduce, with the new model, a three-row, which means it would be that third row in that package. I happen to love the Grand Cherokee because I think it's a great two-row package, and I'm not interested in a third-row package.
But the families
market,
would be.
But
yeah.
The market would be. Yeah. And so you're going to have Jefferson North and Mack building different variations and variants of the Grand Cherokee. Meanwhile, up in Warren, they're going to be launching the Jeep Wagoneer and the Jeep Grand Wagoneer. So think of them as Tahoe fighters or expedition fighters. So a large body on frame made from the truck architecture. And that's going to be coming out of Warren, which is what's producing the Ram pickups. What I think is so interesting about this, it really speaks to brands that are growing. I mean, one of the things that Detroit car companies have been doing for a very long time, let's be honest about it, is managing the decline of their market share. It continues to tick down. The one exception to that is Fiat Chrysler.
How did FCA come to this point?
Two words, Sergio Marchionne. Mm. 3 years ago, the industry thought he was nuts when he said, we're getting out of the car business in the United States. The only cars that Fiat Chrysler brands sell in the United States, and I'm talking about U.S. brands now, come out of Canada and they're rear-wheel drive cars, the 300, the Challenger, and the Charger. They're not doing any other cars. The Dart is gone. The 200 is gone. They saw the trend in SUVs and pickups in the marketplace and acted on it long before GM and Ford did. And they also saw that they could stretch the brand of Jeep, that they could have a lot more entries in the brand and still maintain the DNA of the brand. And it's interesting that a lot of the people who were making those decisions were not American-born people. Sergio Marchionne, Olivier Francois, the head of marketing, these guys saw this stuff and have been able to leverage it and also leverage it in foreign markets. I mean, it's growing outside the United States as well. I think you could argue the Jeep is the most powerful and valuable American automotive brand on the planet. This is nothing but a really good story for Detroit. I mean, they're also making a statement that a real Jeep for the North American market comes out of the industrial Midwest. It's either made in Detroit, or it's made in Toledo, or it's made in Northern Illinois.
Well, we know FCA wants incentives to make this happen. It wants the city of Detroit to buy and provide 200 acres of land and give property tax relief that would let FCA use its property tax payments to pay down some of the project's debt. And this will draw in some criticism. What should FCA promise Detroit and Detroit taxpayers in exchange for the incentives?
Well, there's clearly going to be discussions to reach a community benefits agreement, just like Ford did for the train station. I think FCA is fully willing to do that. They understand they're going to do that. I think the mayor indicated earlier this week that he thinks the biggest challenge is going to be assembling some of the land. Now, the city does own some of that land already. DTE Energy owns some of it. The Great Lakes Water Authority owns some of it. And, of course, the Maroon family owns some of it. So there, those first two, I don't think are going to be much of a problem. And frankly, the Maroon family probably isn't going to be either. It's just going to be haggling about the price and what they're going to get for it. And I think in some cases, the city's going to try to swap land and say, look, we've got these tracks over here. You give us this, we'll do that. Frankly, I don't think this is going to run into a lot of political pushback. People are going to ask questions, but I think FCA and new CEO Mike Manley is very serious about continuing Sergio's approach of being a good corporate citizen and understanding that their bread is buttered here. And that's the point about Jeep and Ram. Those are middle American, all-American, Midwest industrial brands. And they are the most important things that Fiat Chrysler has worldwide. They drive the machine.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Thanks so much, Daniel.
Thank you.
Up next, helping people accept their bodies.
Advertising often uses negative messages to tell us there's something wrong with us and that something needs to be fixed so that we buy the thing that fixes us.
This weekend's Better Body Image Conference happens in Grand Rapids. That's next up on Stateside. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Body image. We can wrestle with this thing our entire lives. You can start being hypercritical of what you see in the mirror when you're still in grade school, and you're still doing it when you're retired, when you're a grandparent. How to break that self-critical voice, accept our bodies. That's the mission of the Better Body Image Conference happening March 2nd in Grand Rapids. Here now is the co-founder of the conference, Connie Flax. She is a dancer with the Grand Rapids Ballet. Connie, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me.
And we also welcome Cassandra Wolf. She is a rehabilitation counselor with Michigan Rehabilitation Services. Cassandra is legally blind and has cerebral palsy, so she will have quite a message when she speaks at the Better Body Image Conference. Cassandra, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much. It's a joy to be here.
Connie, this is the second year now for the Better Body Image Conference. What does it aim to do? What goes on during the day?
The aim is to create cultural change around the way our society views bodies and stigmatizes certain bodies, and this helps individuals make change in the way they view their own body. So to accomplish that really broad goal, we have a full day. We start with brunch and a networking to help people feel comfortable and settle in. We have our keynote speaker, Diane Bondi, and then we break out into workshops. You have your choice of six different workshops, one of which Cassandra is speaking at. And we finish with some movement, with some yoga, dancing, and music by Lady Ace Boogie.
And with, oh, she's great. Lady Ace Boogie is terrific. Cassandra, you're going to be speaking, I know, about the intersection of body image and disability. Tell us more about your connection to this topic.
I think for me, it's a very personal connection. I think the intersection of disability and body image has always been something I've just been very aware of, but didn't have words to put my experience to until about a couple of years ago. Growing up as a young woman who has a visual impairment, that has cerebral palsy, I remember often feeling different than my peers, especially when I wore really thick glasses or I walked with a bit of a gait. I often struggled how to see myself as someone whose body was very different than what people would consider quote-unquote normal. And it's only been in the last 6 or 7 years or so that I've really discovered what it means for me to accept all parts of my body, good and bad, and positive and negative, to empower me to talk about what beauty can be and what confidence and acceptance can look like. So this is a passionate project of mine, too, and I'm really thrilled to share what I've learned and how to help others think about disability, because so often disability is left out of a myriad of conversations when it comes to body image and everything that goes along with that.
In fact, I'm kind of wondering, Cassandra, what kind of messages that people with disabilities get about their bodies, and I'm wondering, are they even present in the conversation?
That's a great question. Well, I would say, yeah, often it's non-present at all. When you think about the way that we have media structured around fashion or, you know, industry in that way of makeup or like things that people clamor for, there's no representation of disability. When we think about dating relationships or moving forward in how body image is presented in that way, disability is very rarely part of the conversation. So in a positive way, it's rarely mentioned. And often so negatively, we hear the body image of something wrong with you because of the medical definition of disability and because of how you need to be changed or fixed. And so if it's mentioned at all, it's often in terms of medical concerns and things that are wrong with a person rather than to focus on their gifts and abilities and interests.
And Connie, you are a professional dancer. You are with the Grand Rapids Ballet, and heaven knows dance, and especially ballet, is a place where there's such hyper-focus on maintaining a lean, slender body type. How have your years as a dancer influenced the way you feel about your own body?
Yeah, so dance takes sort of the culture at large and makes it much narrower and much more specific. So there is that hyper-focus on aesthetic, the same way there is in a lot of other sports. And that was something that I really struggled with. I found myself focusing on the aesthetic of it over a lot of other elements of dance. And it felt like I had to meet a certain way of appearing before I could be valued as an artist or before I could continue to grow as an artist. And it's been a long journey for me and one that I'm still on, working on accepting my body where it's at and using that place of acceptance to change from. But it was really that struggle that made me want to start this conference, because I felt like there had to be other people out there who were feeling similarly and had to be people that I could talk to, but I needed a starting point or a meeting place to talk to those people. And I really wanted that to happen in my own community. So it was really important to me to make a place in Grand Rapids where people could come together, and people who are coming at it from all different angles, whether it's from being a professional athlete or from struggling with an eating disorder or race or disability or sexuality, and we can all connect on the ways that body image affects us.
You know, you stop and you think how your weight and your body image seems to be, in popular culture, so tied to desirability and your worth. Connie, give us some of an example or so that hits you hardest as far as the most kind of the most negative messages we can get about our bodies.
Yeah, I think advertising often uses negative messages to tell us there's something wrong with us and that something needs to be fixed so that we buy the thing that fixes us.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think also, especially for women, we tend to be focused on how to change our own bodies, and that stops us from changing the world. So for me, it's really a social justice issue to have people relate to their bodies in a better way so that they can stop fighting with themselves and get out there and fight with the things that really need to be battled.
And when I think of the Better Body Image Conference, is this for men and women?
It is for men and women. Our board is 5 women. So because of that, it has ended up being more woman-focused. But there are men on Cassandra's panel shared with a man. There are men on the LGBTQ panel. We would love to have men in attendance who need to hear the message and who have things to share, and we're totally open to comments for the future. And we're also interested in non-binary people who want to attend.
Cassandra Wolf, tell us a bit about how you move toward this more positive body image that you say. In the last few years, you've kind of embraced this and you've been able to want to talk about body image. What happened?
I think for me, I've always loved fashion and makeup, but it really kind of happened when I would look to the past and I looked at women like Grace Kelly and Audrey Hepburn. And like Connie was saying, these women were classically beautiful and feminine in ways that I really admired, but they also had hearts for people, and they were also out there doing things to improve their communities, and they were using their beauty to do that. And so when I saw similar people, you know, in popular culture in my own age range, kind of emulating that retro piece, and I said, okay, I love this fashion and this style. I can take that and make it my own. So I feel incredibly confident in finding fashion that is very mid-century modern and tailoring it to my needs, and like having a bright, bold lipstick and that known as my style, and people talk about it and people comment it. And then for me, that changes the conversation from what's wrong with you and your disability and what are the specifics of your diagnosis to, oh, I love that your dress has an interesting hemline, or I love that you wear bright, bold lipstick. For me, it became a power play to change the conversation about me, because I knew with carrying a white cane, people look at me and they make comments, and I thought, well, they might as well make comments on how I present and how I'm maybe different in an interesting artistic way rather than their perception of disability being dowdy and something to be ashamed of.
Speaking of just this kind of representation or national conversation surrounding disability, you probably heard that just recently announced Mattel is marking Barbie's 60th birthday by showcasing 2 new dolls, a Barbie with a prosthetic leg, another Barbie in a wheelchair. And they work closely with individuals who had disabilities in creating that. Do you feel like that's a sign? Is the conversation around disability and body image changing?
I think it is, and I think it's certainly happening with things like DisArt, which they put on a fashion show this past year during Art Prize, and that's how I met Elliot, who is my co-host. And it was this fashion show that was made for models with disabilities. And when Elliot and I met, we got to talk about our experiences and to say, this is a fashion show that says you can be a model, and we're going to showcase your disabilities in a beautiful way, and we're going to dress according to the needs of your disabilities to show on a stage that the life with a disability can be a vibrant, beautiful, vividly lived life that is unashamed of the spotlight and unashamed of being known and seen for who we are.
And Connie Flax, as you get ready to have this second Better Body Image Conference, knowing that there is a world out there where young girls who aspire to be a ballerina like you are, be a professional dancer or a gymnast, and what kind of impact do you want this conference to have, and what do you think it could become?
Yeah, I think the impact within my own professional world has been to show up and be able to talk about the parts of my body that I don't like, but that I accept, to be able to accept the good and the bad of my body and not feel pressured to be this superhuman. I think there's a lot of pressure, especially in the ballet world, to appear as superhuman sometimes. And so to be able to have the conversations, and for me to personally and also professionally through this conference, to offer a space for people who are struggling to know that there's support and know that there are resources out there, and hopefully to help more people who are struggling speak up so that the problem can be addressed more openly and not continually shoved under the rug.
Well, the conference, again, is March 2nd. It's at Grand Valley State University's Eberhardt Center, and you can get more details about that and the Better Body Image Movement by going to betterbodyimageconference.com. Connie Flax and Cassandra Wolf, good luck with the conference and with this mission of helping people to look in the mirror and really embrace what they see. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. It was wonderful.
When you think of statues from ancient Rome, of course, you think of stark white marble. But an exhibition at the U of M Kelsey Museum of Archaeology proves that is not what Julius Caesar or Mark Antony or Scipio Africanus saw. This exhibition is called Ancient Colors. Kathy Person is the co-curator. So the ancient world, Kathy, was colorful and not stark white marble?
No, it was not stark white marble or, you know, boring brick, which is also what you see when you go to visit Rome, right? It's all these brick buildings. Yeah, no, everything would have been bright colors and interesting experience, I think.
So you used modern technology and mm-hmm. found traces of color on pieces in the Kelsey collection. Give us an example.
So actually, the big one that you can see a reconstruction on our website is our head of Bacchus. So my co-curator, Carrie Roberts, did extensive research using different types of light, exposing the sculpture to different types of light. She was able to identify Egyptian blue, some red pigment, two different kinds of red pigment, actually, and even some black outlining the eye, or maybe even what remains of eyelashes that were drawn on the sculpture. And so from that, we were able to interpret what the original may have looked like.
Did that change how you kind of your image of ancient Romans?
So I've been studying the Romans for a very long time because I have been interested in ancient Rome since I was a kid, and I've always thought that it was more colorful than we give it credit for. Just look at all the beautiful wall paintings that we find in Pompeii. So if you imagine that. That's how they're decorating their houses. How could they possibly not be decorating everything else like that too? It just makes sense.
So give us an idea of what's in the exhibition and how you are able to kind of demonstrate these ancient colors.
So we've divided the exhibition into three different themes. The first theme is, where does it all come from? Creating color. So we've created this beautiful map that shows you where all the different pigments and dye raw materials come from, as well as examples of them. I think it's really important for people to see these beautiful green leaves of an indigo plant would have produced that really rich blue dye that we still use today. And, you know, things like rose madder root, which is this ugly little brown root that makes this beautiful orangey pink color. And then the next section of the exhibition looks at how the Romans would have used color. So wall painting, sculpture, also great little, we call it the color quiz. Pick your favorite color and pick up the panel over it. And you can see what words the Romans used to describe the color. Some interesting fun facts about its use in art and clothing and other sort of cultural ways people thought about it based on literature. And then the last section is where we display Carrie's work. So all of the research that she did into the how we know what we know about ancient sculpture and painting.
And what are you hearing from people? I know it's been open since early February. So what are you hearing from people as they go through?
Oh, we've heard nothing but positive things about this exhibition. People love it. I think it's really relatable, this idea of being surrounded by color, because, I mean, we are surrounded by screens and things all the time with bright color, and I think it's a very attractive idea to people. I also think that it's February in Michigan, and it's gray, and I think everyone's excited to come in and see some bright colors and talk about something fun and vibrant on a gray day. So,
and I suspect there's kind of, as people look at these colorful, interpretations and understand the way that color was such a big part of the world of ancient Rome and the Romans, do we start seeing people feel that they're more relatable? Are we closing that the gap of centuries where they
certainly hope so. I think there's a lot of things. Obviously, it's a different culture, different perspective on the world. But I think there are many things that are human, that are relatable, and we can see continuing. And I'm hoping that brings people closer to the past and to understanding and appreciating the past.
Well, I have to tell you, my fascination lifelong with ancient Rome started when I was about 4 years old, and my father took me to see Ben-Hur, and that did it. What pulled you into this?
I have a similar story, actually. I was 8 years old, and somebody gave me a copy of Greek Myth, the Delier's Greek Myth book, the big orange cover, and I read it cover to cover many, 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 many times and decided at 8 that I wanted to study ancient people. So,
and here you are.
And here I am.
What can we learn from the ancients, do you think?
Oh, I think we can learn a bit about ourselves and also some things that have been tried before. Maybe we can try them again, or maybe we shouldn't try them again. I think there's a lot to learn. I think we can see, as you mentioned, I think we can see a little bit of ourselves there and maybe take something away from that.
I think people, as they walk through Pompeii, really mm-hmm. get that feeling mm-hmm. of, oh my goodness, they cooked here and they slept there, and yeah. it is a wonderful thing. Well, the Ancient Colors exhibition will run at the Kelsey Museum of Archaeology until Memorial Day weekend, so plenty of time to get out and take a look at the exhibition. And we've been talking with co-curator Kathy Person with that Kelsey Museum of Archaeology at the University of Michigan. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, Detroit's Shinola got a big shout out during the Oscars, but that left some in the city shaking their heads. We'll find out why. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. That was the opening theme that 121.6 million viewers heard 36 years ago this night as they tuned in for the very final episode of MASH, the most watched TV broadcast in American history to that point. The comedy drama ran from 1972 to 1983, and viewers loved the exploits of the surgeons and nurses of the 4077th MASH unit set during the Korean War. It inspired some viewers to consider medicine as a calling, including a teenager who watched it home in Southfield, Michigan, and who grew up to become University of Michigan medical historian and PBS contributor Dr. Howard Markel. To some who watched, like you, MASH was really all they knew about the Korean War, which certainly did not get the attention of movies and TV the way World War II did.
Yeah.
Or
in fact,
Vietnam.
It's one of the last wars to have a monument on the mall in Washington, D.C. I knew a little bit about the Korean War because my father was in it, but he was luckily billeted in Japan for 2 years. So his tour of duty, as he called it, was quite wonderful. But not a lot of people knew much about that war.
And a lot of Americans learned that term MASH, which stands for?
Mobile Army Surgical Hospital.
And when did the Army start using this idea of treating the wounded soldiers close to the front lines? Because we remember World War I had the ambulance drivers like Ernest Hemingway.
Right.
Bringing the troops
and
way
Walt,
back.
Walt Disney was
Walt
another
Disney
one.
Walt Disney was, yeah. too, yeah.
Yeah, well, it really goes back to the Napoleonic Wars, and the word triage, which everyone's familiar with now, comes from a French word, trier, to sort out. And the notion is, who needs your help most? And if you don't help them right away, they're going to die. Who has the worst battle wound? Whose organ is destroyed? What have you? This process has been improved upon to a real state of the art currently in wartime medicine. But beginning in the end of the World War II, some famous surgeons, including Michael DeBakey, were consulted as to how to bring a unit that could operate on patients, on soldiers, close to the front, but not too close to the front that the entire hospital staff would be in jeopardy. And so they were originally called auxiliary surgical groups, and then World War II ended. But when Korean War started in 1950, they revamped and revised that process, and it became the MASH units.
And that's what we saw. And didn't a lot of what we now know as emergency medicine kind of have its roots there?
Well, I don't know if a lot, but certainly traumatic injuries have their roots in wartime. Sadly, wartime has advanced medicine across the ages. I mean, when you think of the Civil War, more men died of dysentery than of bullets, and they learned to wash their hands and to dig latrines that were far away from where they ate. And you could go on with surgical wounds, too, that they were advanced and improved upon and even created during wartime in places like MASH units, yes.
And before Alan Alda and that great cast starred on the TV show, there was a movie version with Elliot Gould, I remember that, based on a novel. So tell us about the author and why this all seems so realistic.
Well, that's what's so fascinating to me. I remember the novel vividly. It was a pen name, Richard Hooker, but his real name was H. Richard Hornberger. And he was drafted in 1950 right out of his surgical internship. So that means he only had about a year of training.
So he was a baby doctor.
He was a baby doctor. Not the kind of baby doctors we think of.
Early in his training, a very young doctor. Yeah,
baby doctor. Yeah. And he was put into one of these MASH units. And he was from Maine, as Hawkeye Pierce is from. And he based Hawkeye Pierce on himself. And the interesting thing is that he wrote all these memoirs in a novelistic form, almost as a therapy for the post-traumatic stress disorder that he must have suffered from. Because even though these units were a little bit away from the front, they were close enough to be quite frightening. And they were seeing the worst of the worst. I mean, the types of injuries that they saw on a daily basis. And I think that comes through in both the movie and the TV show were horrific.
But you found Dr. Hornberger didn't make a pile of money from the TV show, nor did he like it very much.
No. He signed a bad deal. You ought to go back to his agent. He passed away a while ago, but he made about $500 an episode. More than that, though, he did not like the show because he felt it, quote, trampled on my memories. What he was writing was a memoir of his war work, but it wasn't an anti-war novel. It wasn't a political novel. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Dr. Hornberg was quite conservative politically, and he found the Alan Alda characterization of Hawkeye, which he was very invested in. Hawkeye was quite liberal, anti-war, and some of this was reflected in how many Americans felt at the time about the Vietnam War. And so a lot of us who were watching back then could really identify with this stuff. So Dr. Hornberger was not a fan.
There are some Michigan connections to the TV show. Actor Harry Morgan, who played Colonel Potter, was born in Detroit in 1915, and he grew up in Muskegon, actually graduated in 1933 from Muskegon High School. And then tell us about the surgeon who made sure that the scenes on the TV show were as authentic as possible.
Walter Deschelles, who was a 1965 or 6 graduate of U of M Medical School, and he practiced out in California.
And he grew up in Detroit, right?
Grew up in Detroit. Yeah. And he was the medical advisor for a whole host of medical shows on the CBS television network.
Oh, they had bunches of them.
Yeah.
They really did.
There was Aftermath, there was House Calls, there was Medical Center. There was a whole bunch of them. And so he made quite a good living, not only from his surgical practice, but more famously as an expert in medicine. And what he did was he read up on the types of procedures that were being done at that time so that it was fairly accurate.
Here's a clip from the very final moments of that final episode. You have Alan Alda as Hawkeye Pierce about to chop her out of Korea as the war ends, saying farewell to his best buddy, B.J. Honeycutt, played by Mike Farrell. Hawkeye speaks first.
Look, I know how tough it is for you to say goodbye, so I'll say it. Maybe you're right. Maybe we will see each other again. But just in case we don't, I want you to know how much you've meant to me. I'll never be able to shake you. Whenever I see a big pair of feet or a cheesy mustache, I'll think of you.
Whenever I smell month-old socks, I'll think of you.
And the next time somebody nails my shoe to the floor.
Yeah, when somebody gives me a martini that tastes like lighter fluid. I'll miss you. A lot. I can't imagine what this place would have been like if I hadn't found you here.
Why do you think, Howard, that this show grabbed audiences the way it did for all of these years, over 10 years? Why did it grab you?
Well, it was so well written, and the characters were so three-dimensional. Even when one character left the show and another joined the cast, it was as if it never happened. It was just so organic and wonderful. And it was funny, and it was sad, and it was touching. And Hawkeye Pierce was the doctor we all wanted to be.
Why?
He was very competent. He was a very good surgeon. And yet he had a wonderful bedside manner. And you know, if you're a Groucho Marx fan, you don't have to go very far to see Alan Alda's portrayal. In fact, in one episode, he actually dressed up like Groucho Marx. But those one-liners, those funny anecdotes that just came up and up and up again, just impressed me enormously and enchanted me.
And here we have how many years in medicine now for you?
Over 30.
There you go. And you can thank those early seasons.
Well, yeah, and I don't meet helipads anymore, thankfully, for both the patient and the helipad. But every time we crab rocked across the helipad, I could hear that song, Suicide is Painless, the theme song of MASH in my head.
University of Michigan medical historian Dr. Howard Markell, as we mark this anniversary of the final episode of MASH 36 years ago this night, 121.6 million people watched. Howard, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It was a curious shout-out in the middle of a Sunday night Oscar acceptance speech. Director Peter Farrelly getting his Oscar for Best Original Screenplay for the movie Green Book, dropping a torrent of names for thank yous, and then this.
Tom Katsiotis and Shinola Watches, unbelievable. They're saving Detroit.
And last fall, Kanye West talked to TMZ about his upcoming visit to Detroit to see Dan Gilbert.
I'm meeting with Dan Gilbert tomorrow, who's healing Detroit.
Which begs the questions, who gets to decide who is saving Detroit, or indeed whether Detroit is in need of saving and healing? With us is Kim Trent, a Detroit-based writer, a former journalist. She sits on the Wayne State University Board of Governors and a lifelong Detroiter. Kim, it's great to have you with us on Stateside.
Oh, I'm so thrilled to be here. Thank you.
Kim, how did Peter Farrelly's Shinola shout-out during the Oscars land on you when you heard it?
To be honest with you, when I first heard it, I was kind of happy. I am really excited by Shinola. I was in L.A. recently, and I kind of was wandering around and stumbled upon their showroom in Los Angeles, and I really felt like it was a part of home. So I'm excited by Shinola. So my first response, frankly, was, oh, that's cool. And then the word sank in, and I realized, oh, did he just say they're saving Detroit? That's not good. But I have to admit, at first it sounded great. And then just the saving part is, you know, clearly problematic. And, you know, as a lifelong Detroiter, that's a narrative that is, you know, as you mentioned, Kanye West with the Dan Gilbert quote, mm-hmm. and many, many, many others. Detroit is kind of in the spotlight now, which is a good thing. But I think the unfortunate thing is those of us who've been here on the ground all along, saving Detroit, keeping Detroit together with shoestrings and bubblegum, you know, get ignored. And, you know, that's a very kind of frustrating feeling.
All right, let's start right on the ground level. Is Detroit in need of saving?
Well, I mean, certainly we've gone through a very rough time. I mean, we've faced bankruptcy, we faced white flight, and then followed by middle class, black flight. And we're a city that definitely needed some shoring up. But I think that the shoring up kind of started at the ground level. I think that people who lived here, who stayed, who, you know, when their neighbors died or moved out, took care of abandoned homes so that they didn't, you know, drag down property values in the neighborhood, or, you know, did community gardens, or held people accountable when they were opening businesses in their neighborhoods. I mean, those are the people who saved Detroit, if there was a saving that took place. I mean, certainly, I don't think anyone who's been around here, I mean, we definitely went through a period, I would say, maybe 10 years ago, or, you know, 7 or 8 years ago, where things were pretty desperate. I mean, even as a native Detroiter who has always had tremendous hope and optimism for the city, there were times I drove through neighborhoods, particularly when the housing bubble happened, and it was pretty bad. I mean, things got pretty desperate. But I think that that's why the heroes truly are those of us who stayed through that storm. You know, and we're very happy to have the folks who are coming back and the folks who are never here who are coming. You know, it's certainly a hot destination now. I think very few people in Detroit aren't excited about having some diversity, excited about having particularly economic diversity, which is what we need the most.
Yeah. In fact, when I think about a Shinola in Midtown, a Nike mm-hmm. store downtown on Woodward, what roles do you see big brands like that playing in the city's post-bankruptcy resurgence?
Well, I think more than anything, it's psychological. You know, I told the story about the other day when I was going to the gym and I realized I left my bag with my sweatpants and gym shoes at home. And I really needed to go to this class for exercise. And I worked downtown and I thought, oh, wait a minute, we have a Nike store downtown now. And, you know, for most people, that just seems like such an ordinary thing. But in a city like Detroit that had nothing, I lived in downtown Detroit for 12 years, right in the heart of downtown. You know, there was no CVS, there was no dry cleaners, there was no grocery store at all. I mean, just very ordinary kind of amenities that you would expect in any major city, we simply did not have. So there is something psychological about having access to things that other people take for granted when you've been denied it for a long time. But I think that the heart of Detroit is the people. You know, I think one of the things that people are surprised about when they visit here is just the quality of our housing stock. We have beautiful homes. We have neighborhoods that are still very strong. But yeah, I mean, I think brands like Shinola, their new hotel downtown is amazing and beautiful. Their story, their narrative about really being kind of a unique Detroit institution, even though it wasn't started by people from Detroit, it's not really organically Detroit, but it has claimed its stake as an organic Detroit destination. And, you know, I'm like, come on, let's make this happen. But I do think that there has to be an effort to respect the people who were here on the ground all along.
Indeed. It's worth noting that as soon as they got the shout out in the Oscar, Shinola came out with a statement like, well, thanks. But, you know, without the city of Detroit, there would be no Shinola, that the city gave
right.
our brand life.
Which I think was very wise for them to do, because, I mean, certainly social media heated up pretty quickly after that. I mean, people were pretty offended by the statement. And then also, I think you have to also look at the context of who was delivering that message, because Peter Farrelly had just won for Green Book, which is a movie that a lot of people kind of perceived as being kind of a white savior story too. So it was kind of a double whammy. People were already irritated about Green Book, and then you had him saying, oh, and here's another great white guy who's saving black people.
So you know, and let me ask you that, because when you think of those words saving and healing, and in these cases they're being used about powerful white men working in a city that's 80% African-American, and you point mm-hmm. to, you know, the points that are being made about the Green Book. Why do those racial tropes, the white knight narrative, why are those persisting in 2019?
Well, I think they persist. I think it's human nature that you want to believe that people are fundamentally good. And I think, you know, one of the things that I've been thinking about with Green Book, why it kind of bugged me so much, why the movie bugged me, you know, this white knight trope. And the problem is, I think that when you examine individual, you know, someone having kind of an individual transformation, racial transformation, where they were maybe racist or prejudiced, and then kind of because of a relationship with a person of color, kind of transcended it, it puts the emphasis on individual racism when that's not really the problem. The problem is systemic racism. And it kind of absolves white folks because, you know, I think on a personal level, most white people would think that they're not racist. But I think when you start looking at systems, that's a much more difficult thing to attack. And so I think when you have a movie like Green Book that really pushes people to say, oh, we're going to solve racism one person at a time, you know, that's probably not a way that you're really going to solve racism. I mean, it really has to be, we as a society have to sit back and look at how structures are in place and systems are in place that separate people and prevent people from having opportunity. And that's a hard discussion to have. You know, someone going out and having fried chicken with someone and then form a relationship, that's easy work. That's not the hard work.
Let me circle back to wind up with Detroit. Kim, you get to say this as a lifelong Detroiter who has watched the city's narrative unfold. Who gets to decide what Detroit needs?
Well, I think the people who live here. I think the people who live, I mean, although I certainly, because I saw some pretty harsh criticisms of Shinola that I thought were unfair. You know, I definitely think Shinola's, you know, there have been some questions about the impact that Shinola really could have on a community, how many employees they really have on the ground here and that kind of thing. But I mean, I think we should give credit to some corporate folks who are coming in and trying to provide jobs and trying to provide, I mean, it provides an economic base, which is, you know, something that Detroit has been lacking for a long time. So I think that there's that piece. But I also think that the people who are on the ground here, who have invested, who have stayed for generations, who stayed when it wasn't cute or fun, even in some cases safe, they ultimately really have to be the decision makers, and they have to be the ones who are kind of charting Detroit's future. And again, that doesn't mean that we're not accepting new people or we don't want new people to come and enjoy the energy and the momentum we're enjoying right now. But I think people need to be mindful of having respect for those who have been here and never left.
Kim Trent, writer, former journalist. She's on the Wayne State University Board of Governors. And it has been a pleasure talking with you today on Stateside. Kim, thank you so very much.
Thank you so much, Cynthia. It's such a pleasure to talk to you always.
As we slog through this long, cold winter, let me invite you to daydream a little. Dream about a lovely summer day in Paris or the French Riviera, of staying in a 15th century French chateau, or walking the historic beaches of Normandy on this 75th anniversary summer of the D-Day invasion, and a whole lot more. Well, that daydream can happen because I am leading Michigan Radio listeners on a tour of France this summer. Most of the spaces on the tour are taken, but we have a handful of spots left for you to come along on this beautiful French adventure with us. Just visit michiganradio.org/travel, and you'll get all the details. Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Peg Watson. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstrom. Today's contributors are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Laura Weber Davis, Joey Horan, Bella Isaacs, Razi Joffrey, Sarah Leeson, and Katie Raymond. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.